This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. It's the most wonderful time of the year, according to some holiday songs. Many of us are buzzing around, preparing our menus, racing from store to store, trying to find the best sales, and maybe even prepping our guest rooms for visiting family. But for some, the holidays can also bring up the pain of the past. Things that we think may have been long forgotten can boil over and erupt right in the middle of that big family dinner and ruin everything. Today on Embodied, we're talking about the art and science of forgiveness. Joining us first is someone who has spent decades researching this topic. Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitvliet is a professor and department chair of psychology at Hope College. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you today.
Tell me about your definition of forgiveness. Let's start there. It's such a big topic, so I'd love to know how you define it.
It is a very big topic, and I'd like to preface it by saying that when we're thinking about forgiveness, we need to remember to establish safety first and to make sure that wrongdoing is halted. It turns out that forgiveness often naturally takes root in the soil of safety, responsibility, and accountability.
So talk about that safety. Yeah, how do you set that up?
Well, I think it's crucial to assess whether people are safe emotionally, relationally, psychologically, physically, sexually. And if they're not, then ensuring that safety is our top priority. And if they are, then talking about accountability is also very important because repentant wrongdoers want to be accountable for the impact of their actions, often unintended impacts, but also intended impacts. And they want to amend their ways because going forward, they want to live as changed people.
So you say that for repentant wrongdoers. How about those who maybe aren't repentant, for people that don't readily apologize? Mm-hmm. How does forgiveness work in those situations?
Well, as it turns out, we can't control other people very well, can we? And so when it comes to people who desire to grant forgiveness and who do hold someone else accountable for a blameworthy transgression that was hurtful, they can still pursue forgiveness in a way that does not in any way get rid of the need for responsibility. And so I would say this, that forgiveness is one moral response to injustice that takes seriously the harm caused by an offense, and it doesn't minimize, excuse, or tolerate the injustice.
Well, but are rather, there different? Yeah, go ahead. Continue.
Oh, that when victims forgive, they're resisting allowing the past to define their present or to define their future. They take an active role in focusing on the humanity of that offender, seeing the offense as evidence of needed change, and then trying to genuinely wish the offender well.
So we asked our audience about their personal struggles and stories with forgiveness, and I want to get right into one of those to kind of help set up this conversation for us. So this is a listener named Camilla who had struggled with self-forgiveness. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Camilla. When I was 16, I was in a car accident where I was the driver. The car accident ultimately injured everybody in the car and resulted in my close friend, who is the passenger, becoming quadriplegic, meaning no movement from the neck down. The accident was a freak accident. Nobody was under the influence. We were wearing seat belts in the front seats, and there was no speeding. However, it was quite an unforgivable act in my mind, being the driver and being responsible for your passengers. And so the struggle began. Fast forward, it's been over 25 years, and my girlfriend and I still stay in touch with one another, and she is actually the reason why I started opening up to, you know, the harm and when you can't forgive yourself for an act, for a trauma, and looking at situations that are out of your control and how to move past them. My girlfriend's parents and she both emphasized that they had forgiven me and I needed to forgive myself, which is easy to say, but not an easy thing to do.
That's listener Camilla Christensen, and we're talking to Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitvliet. She researches forgiveness and is a professor and department chair of psychology at Hope College. So any thoughts about that? It's really a heartbreaking experience.
It is. And Camilla, I want to say that I so value your willingness to name the reality of the hurt that you were involved in as the driver, and also the hurt that you've experienced, your empathy for everyone who was injured and affected, your ability to remain in relationship with your friend who became a quadriplegic, and to receive the gifts that she and the others you named have given you in offering you forgiveness for that. So one of the things that I'm so struck by is that this is a deeply traumatic sort of experience. And there's no way to sort of hit rewind and do real life over again in a way that eliminates all of the hurts and harms that you gave voice to. And I'm so deeply grateful that you do have the very people you're most concerned about here who have been so gracious with you, and that they've encouraged you to really embrace that grace and forgiveness and to be able to live and walk in that going forward.
Yeah. Well, you've been researching forgiveness for a really long time, and maybe you can tell us a bit about the reasons why forgiveness is so important to our health. You've actually studied this in a lab, which is so interesting. So tell us about how you've tested forgiveness in this laboratory setting.
Sure. So in the lab, we've studied the psychological, emotional, and embodied side effects of processes like forgiveness or hurtful rumination and grudge holding. From the perspective of the victim at first, but we also moved into the perspective of the person who finds that they are the ones who are accountable for having harmed others through some sort of wrong, which Camilla has named. And if I could start there with Camilla's story, one of our more recent studies on forgiveness seeking, rooted in humble repentance, revealed that receiving forgiveness from another and embracing forgiveness oneself, when rooted in humble repentance, are like fraternal twins. They are action-packed with emotional and physiological side effects that really quiet down the negativity, the intensity, and the stress.
Well, what are those physiological side effects?
Yes, right. So by contrast, when people are self-condemning, for example, their heart rate escalates and their cardiovascular regulation mechanism, heart rate variability for those who are interested, is impaired. And that tells us that self-regulation is taking a nosedive when people are beating themselves up over wrongs that they've committed. But instead, when they engage the reality of that in an honest way and they seek to root out whatever may have been linked with those actions that led to the costly outcome, and they really try to make a deep change in their life, and they seek forgiveness, that even if they imagine being begrudged by their victim, if we want to use that word, or if they receive forgiveness from that person, or if they embrace forgiveness themselves, all of those responses involve less escalation of heart rate and less impairment in the cardiovascular regulatory response.
So it's so interesting. You all actually ask people to think about an instance where someone has wronged them, and you kind of track how the way that they're thinking about this and the lens that they're putting on it impacts how they are responding physiologically. So maybe you can give us insight into what you encourage people to do to get out of that state of rumination, to maybe calm down some of these physiological symptoms that may be happening when we're in this state of rumination.
Right. We've studied that victim perspective a lot, and there are some common themes. So if a person wants to forgive and they want to really be about the business of telling more of the truth, not less, they can remember first that the offender is a human being, a person. They can see the blameworthy offense as evidence of that person's need to change and to grow. And then they can find even a small way to genuinely wish the offender well in being transformed. And then they need to remember that forgiveness can be real, even in those circumstances where the relationship can't continue, or if the person can't be restored to their position. And every step of the way, we can prioritize safety and accountability for the good of the victim, the good of the offender, and the good of the community.
So what does real forgiveness look like in a situation where the relationship can't be restored? I only have about 30 seconds before we go to break, but maybe you can explain that.
Yes. So in the lab, we ask people to identify a real-life offender and then to focus on the offender's humanity in any experiences or even deficiencies in that person's life that are connected to the kind of action that was unjust and hurtful. And then to use that as a way to illuminate, like, what is it that that person really needs as a change in their life? And when you desire that good change for that person, there are so many different psychological and emotional and physiological side effects that ensue. And they're calmer and more positive and certainly more forgiving. They're less associated with stress. And so it's really quite compelling that we find this again and again.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that you become blind to the ways that they've wronged you, but you kind of accept you're not going to go back, you're not going to change the past, and maybe there's a way you can increase how you think about their humanity or take a zoomed out view of this whole situation.
That's right. That wide angle lens is really important in telling more of the truth, not less.
All right. My guest is Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitfleet. We'll continue our conversation with her and other guests as we talk about forgiveness. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We are exploring the art and science of forgiveness today. Despite everything we know about its transformative power, it can be really challenging. Still with me is Charlotte Van Ooyen-Whitfleet. She's a professor and department chair of psychology at Hope College. She researches forgiveness. And bringing in one other guest to the conversation now is Reverend Irene Monroe. She is a lesbian feminist public theologian. She co-hosts the podcast All Revved Up on Boston Public Radio, and she's a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Irene Monroe, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So we were called to attention to your work because of a piece that you wrote earlier this year after an incident that has gotten a lot of people talking about forgiveness. So ex-Dallas police officer Amber Geiger was sentenced to 10 years in prison for the murder of her unarmed neighbor, Botham Jean. And the video of what happened in that courtroom has gone viral. For those of you who didn't see it, Botham Jean's younger brother asked to hug Geiger after delivering his impact statement. The judge then also gave Geiger a hug and her personal Bible. It's quite a moment. And I would love to hear how you responded to this in the context of thinking about forgiveness.
Sure. Well, first, let me say this here. I define forgiveness as sort of an acknowledgement and practice towards right relationship with oneself, with God, and the person or persons offended. And I feel that it should be rooted in acts of doing justice with the hope of what? Restoration, reconciliation, and continued responsibility. And what I mean by that, I'm moved by a quote by Martin Luther King, who says that forgiveness is not an occasional act. It is a constant attitude. Mm. And so I had to begin. I wrote the article that got a lot of traffic, and it was titled, Why Black Folks Are the Most Forgiving. And I had to begin to really wrestle with this topic, because in many ways, I feel that we give away forgiveness like we give away confetti, and I'm always trying to help my parishioners and students that there are ways that the way in which Christian concept of forgiveness can be beneficial in terms of enhancing healing and creating positive change, but at the same time, it can cause tremendous harm by maintaining the status quo. So I wrote the article because I thought that the incident with the former Dallas police officer was an excellent example to help people to do a couple of things. One of which is to make the distinction between individual forgiveness and institutional forgiveness, as well as this distinction between blind obedience versus reasoned faith. So
okay,
let's
pause there to kind of pick those apart, because the first one that you said is really important, I think central to your argument and central to how a lot of people are thinking about this conversation. So you say separate individual forgiveness from institutional forgiveness. And I want to play a quick clip here of Botham Jean's mother. And she responded to this event, and I think kind of illustrates that distinction. So let's listen to a quick clip of her.
What Brand did was to cleanse his heart towards Amber. I do not want it to be misconstrued as a complete forgiveness of everybody.
So that's Botham Jean's mother, Allison, on CBS This Morning, sharing her thoughts about why she thinks her son offered Amber Geiger a hug and forgiveness, and kind of how she hopes the public interprets that, which is not exactly how the public has been interpreting it. So tell me more about your distinction between individual and institutional forgiveness.
Yeah, well, what he did was exactly certainly what I define as individual forgiveness. However, whatever it is to help you heal, restore yourself to wholeness, to feel, you know, complete again and have that ability to move forward, that is individual. And how we do that is up to the person. And a lot of times it is shaped by their religious belief and practices. The distinction here is what the judge did, Judge Tammy Kemp. Now, what her act was what I call institutional forgiveness. And what I mean by that is that this is where the judge got off the stage, went into her chamber, came back out with a Bible, turned to John 3:16, and that was problematic, largely because she represents the state. And we try to make that distinction between church and state. And by her doing that, there's an institutional forgiveness in the context of where we are saying that Black Lives Matter, we're seeing a rash of unarmed Black men be gunned down in the streets of America. So that is where people couldn't see much of what was happening, because it got conflated as everyone is doing the same thing. No, the judge is representing the state.
Yeah.
And the young man is representing himself.
Well, Charlotte, I want to bring you back into the conversation here. Charlotte Van Oyen-Whitbleed, a professor and department chair of psychology at Hope College. How did you respond to this hug and this question of institutional versus individual forgiveness? Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
I wanted to say thank you for making that distinction, Reverend Irene. I think it's really crucial to do so. And as I was thinking about the 18-year-old brother of Botham Jean, so the 18-year-old Brandt and his offer of personal forgiveness, he seemed so clear about it. He said, "If you are truly sorry, I can speak for myself. I know I can speak for myself. I forgive you." And it's what my brother would have wanted. So that was his understanding. And he said, each and every one has steps to get towards actually forgiving. And I probably went through those faster than other people. And if you're trying to forgive her, understand she's a human being. So I have a lot of empathy for this traumatized young man, this brother,
yeah,
and for the mother and for the father. And I think it's very possible that the judge was very, very moved by this. My reading of the story is very much shaped by an article by Eric Ortiz on NBC News. And so it's possible that I don't have all of the details. But as I unpacked it, it sounded like she said, "Mr. Jean has forgiven you. Please forgive yourself so you can live a purposeful life." And that then Geiger asked if her life could be purposeful, to which Judge Kemp personally gifted a Bible. And then when Geiger asked for a hug, Judge Kemp gave it to her.
Yeah, well, I want to zoom out just a tiny bit from this specific incident to kind of get to this core thing that I think you're trying to articulate in your piece, Reverend Irene Monroe, which is the first line, even. You say, "Black Christians give away forgiveness like it's confetti, and white evangelicals give it away sparingly, if at all." So what is different about how the concept of forgiveness is taught and practiced in Black Christian spaces versus white?
Yeah, so this is where I get to the second part, where I says that we have to make this distinction between blind obedience versus reasoned faith. And what I'm saying here, in a nutshell, is that while Christianity is not a toxic religion, the form of Christianity taught to my ancestors was not to make us better Christians, but rather better slaves. And so that we have to begin to look at how much of the remnants of that is trickled in our understanding of forgiveness. And so when I say that, I also look at, you know, a particular scriptures, you know, in the Bible, that when we say here, and because many will say, well, you know, Jesus says, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Absolutely. But if we leave that forgiveness that Jesus utters on the cross, we then don't look at the oppressions and the principalities that put him on the cross. So then we don't make the distinction, or we don't understand that Jesus was on the cross because he was Jewish, and that we got to understand that what are the powers today that put people on the cross. For example, when we look at lynching in America, we got to look at it as similar to Jesus being on the cross. What was going on at that time? Jim Crow America. Or when we look at what happened to Matthew Shepard, we got to look at him in the context of America during a very homophobic time.
Well, that's interesting, because I think you're pointing to this question here of humanity. It's not that we don't want people to see Amber Guyger as a human or recognize her humanity, but we want to extend this humanity to everyone. We want to extend this humanity to innocent people who are shot at the hands of police. And so I'm wondering, I mean, how do you preach about forgiveness in the face of this systemic injustice? You're very much confronted with this as someone who has a congregation. How do you handle that?
Yeah, well, what I do is largely, I mean, I always have to say that as people who live at the intersections of multiple identities and multiple kinds of suffering brought on, you know, by racial prejudice, that that's where we have to make that distinction between blind obedience. We don't forgive just to forgive. We forgive with the hope of not only wholeness for ourselves, but for greater humanity. Mm-hmm. And then we have to realize this, too, when I say reasoned faith, that when we use a reasoned faith in light of doing justice, it spreads out like sunshine. It resonates out in the world. We then can example it. We begin to model it. And we will get away from that sort of, I call it this buzz, that we automatically assume black folks just give away forgiveness. And it's far more complex than the way in which it's reported in the news or even seen in that moment in the courtroom.
I want to talk about this question of truth-telling, because I feel like it's come up kind of throughout our conversation that an important step in getting to a space of real healing is acknowledging that there has to be this moment of truth-telling where one person says to another, this is what happened, this is maybe why it happened, here's how I'm going to do it differently. I wonder, Charlotte, if you can talk a little bit about how you see the role of truth-telling in forgiveness, both on an individual and an institutional level.
Yes, let's start at the institutional level. And I want to thank you, Reverend Irene, for your expressions today. They're just very powerful, and they need to stop us in our tracks. And we need to engage them in profound ways and reflect deeply on some of the unintended impacts of our actions and assumptions and our failures to act. And it seems to me that when systemic harms have occurred, then accountable change is the priority in moving towards that right relationship that Reverend Irene was talking about. And it's possible that justice and forgiveness can work together, but it's often very difficult and there's a dance involved. But it's really crucial that we get that right. It's very important that the heavy lifting of generosity not be imbalanced, that not be made out to be the responsibility of Black Americans who are often bearing the brunt of oppression and a distortion of the gospel that was preached in order to make them subservient. And that's very important. And I am nervous about the over-exuberant reception of what I believe was genuine on the part of 18-year-old Brant Jean. I'm cautious about the over-exuberance amongst white Christians, as if end of story, now we're done. Isn't that a powerful story? And it is, but that's when we need to roll up our sleeves and get to work and root out the biases within ourselves, the racisms within ourselves, and those that are systemically embedded that consistently lead to unjust outcomes. So,
yeah, I want to bring up another recent moment that happened actually this past weekend. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg made headlines. He just announced his candidacy for the president, and he went to a predominantly black church in Brooklyn to apologize for the stop and frisk policy. So let's listen to a clip of his apology.
I got something important really wrong. I didn't understand that back then, the full impact that stops were having on the black and Latino communities. I was totally focused on saving lives, but as we know, good intentions aren't good enough.
Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg asking the black and Latinx community for forgiveness last weekend. I'm here with Reverend Irene Monroe, as well as Charlotte Van Oyen Witt Vliet. So, Reverend Monroe, what is your take on this apology?
Okay, well, I can't even take it seriously. It's more than a day late and a dollar short for a lot of reasons, one of which the many lives that have been impacted by his stop and frisk law. I think what he does is two things that he doesn't recognize here. Not only is that a flawed law that was legislated, he exploits the black church as a place to come and get immediate absolution. So, and he's like so many white politicians, is that no really engagement in the lives of black people, but that Tuesday, you know, that Sunday before that Tuesday, we go to the poll,
right.
They show up. And so it's disingenuous, it's a disconnect. And to come, you know, his stop and frisk, not only did it ruin so many lives, if he was engaged with the black community, he would have seen that. I think what we got to understand is that while we are trying to move white people to be more woke about their white privilege and power, it's important to have laws in place. So, for instance, here, you may hate me because I'm black, but if you have hate crimes, or because I'm a lesbian, but if you have hate crimes on the book, and you legislate them, I might not change your heart about me, but I will certainly change your behavior because I have the state that is protecting me. The individual act of forgiveness, I believe that it's long. I do believe that it will be bent towards justice. But while we get to that justice moment, I do need some laws immediately in place to protect people who are most vulnerable to these kinds of acts of hatred.
Well, it's interesting because I think we have to make a distinction here between guilt and forgiveness, because it seems to me that you could interpret his comments as coming from maybe a place of white guilt, of realizing, you know, saying, I was innocent, I didn't realize. So I guess for you, do you think about white guilt as having a role in how people think about forgiveness and the ability to understand what it actually is to forgive?
And this is my question. Do I think about white
guilt?
Yes. Oh, well, it's never been my province to think about it. I've always been subjected to it. It is an enigma for me, but I think that what white guilt does is that it impedes the progress that needs to be done. It's almost like I'm sorry more about being caught for what I've done than the actual change that needs to be done.
Charlotte, maybe you can take that one then.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that you're right on that. If white guilt impedes progress in rooting out all that is driving white actions that are harmful and unexamined biases and systemic structures, including laws that are unjust, or that there may even be just laws that are enacted inequitably, that all of those things undermine the deep alignment we need to be engaging in for that long arc that bends towards justice.
Well, we only have about a minute left, but we've kind of traced a variety of kinds of forgiveness here. We've talked about it as a spiritual act, as a very practical act, an intellectual act. I'm wondering if each of you kind of has a forgiveness mantra that you personally live by, that you can kind of leave our listeners to think about as they go into maybe stressful holiday gatherings. Charlotte, let's start with you.
It seems to me that whether we're coming at forgiveness questions from the perspective of victim or wrongdoer, and whether we're thinking about just forgiveness or accountability as primary, that remembering the humanity of those involved is crucial. It's so crucial to tell more of the truth, not less, and to understand not only intent, but unintended impacts of our actions and our inactions, to really be able to hear the perspective of others, and to be able then not just to engage in condemnation of them or self-condemnation, which really isn't about accountable change, but really sidetracks us, that instead we need to be investing in making the sort of accountable changes that lean into that good future.
Reverend Monroe, I have about 10 seconds for your answer.
Okay. I love this quote by King. He says that we must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. He who is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power to love. There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. Mm-hmm. And it's there that we understand that we are a complex individual, but we can always, even in our worst moments, have that capacity to change and to forgive.
Beautiful. Thanks both. Yes. Thanks so much to both of you. We will continue our conversation about forgiveness just ahead with behavioral economist Dan Ariely. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. On this edition of Embodied, we are talking about forgiveness. There's an art and a science behind forgiving ourselves and others, but forgiveness is not always rational. I know that it's far easier for me to forgive my dog for destroying my favorite sweater than for me to forgive the dry cleaner for doing the very same thing. Joining us now is behavioral economist Dan Ariely. He's written 6 books about human behavior and explored topics ranging from the power of I'm sorry to how companies can seek forgiveness from their patrons. Dan is the director and founder of the Center for Advanced Hindsight and a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Lovely to be here.
How do you define forgiveness?
Okay. So maybe it's good to think about what's forgiveness and what's not forgiveness.
Okay.
So imagine you did something terrible to me, and we'll not imagine exactly what you did, but let's... The non-forgiveness path, there may be 2 of them. One is withdrawal, right? I'll just say, I never want to see you again. Why would I want to expose myself to that? The second one is revenge. Hmm. And revenge is really interesting because revenge means that I'm so upset with you that I'm willing to sacrifice my own money, happiness, time to teach you a lesson. Right?
Okay.
If you think about what revenge is, it's an unbelievable investment in the other person. And to some degree, you know, if you say something mild, like you violated or I don't care a lot about you, I'm not going to get into revenge. But I really need to care a lot about you, and I need to figure out that what you did to me is incredibly personal and offensive for me to be willing to sacrifice the time and energy needed for revenge.
So there's some kind of threshold. Is it irrational? Do we respond irrationally to kind of deciding what crosses this threshold and what doesn't?
So it's certainly not rational. Actually, revenge is not rational, right? So withdrawal is, right? So imagine you did something bad to me, saying I never want to see you again, perfectly reasonable. Saying I want to invest time to punish you, that's a crazy idea from a rational perspective, right? Why would I when I should just withdraw? But we have this very strong instinct. By the way, it's a good instinct. Why is it a good instinct? Because imagine a small society, let's say we're 200 people. If one of us does bad things to other people and we feel revenge, that acts as the police and justice force,
okay,
right? Because if people know that revenge exists in society, the cost of behaving badly is much higher, right? If I thought that if I did something bad to you, the worst you could do is withdraw from me, not so bad.
So knowing the consequences of the action may shape how people behave.
That's right. So it's not rational on the individual level, but for society, it's a very good mechanism. So that's the non-forgiveness part.
Okay.
Right? And now what is forgiveness? Forgiveness is basically saying, I had these terrible experiences, I can withdraw, I can revenge, but instead I'm going to try and understand you and pretend that this never happened. Now, not exactly pretend it didn't happen, but try to bypass this transgression.
So from a behavioral perspective, what makes people more likely to forgive than not, would you say?
The first thing you want for forgiveness is that there's a need for forgiveness, right? So I'm completely unmotivated to forgive somebody I never met and would never meet again, and there's no reason for that. So I need to have some objective in forgiving them. For example, maybe it's my spouse, right? And we're still together, and if I don't forgive them, I'll...
There are real consequences.
There are real consequences. So I need to do that. And then the second part is getting rid of the darkness within our soul, right? So if you think about the Count of Monte Cristo, right? Maybe the ultimate revenge story of somebody who was like engaged in thinking about revenge and executing it for many years. This was his life goal, was revenge. Amazing book, but I don't think we would want to live our life this way, right? So there's something about revenge that is of course negative to the other person, negative to our relationship, but also negative to ourselves. So at some point, forgiveness is good for our own psyche. And there may be two types of forgiveness. There's one that is just a consequence of time, right? Something bad happened to me 10 years later. I might not even remember that. And the second one is the more direct one. The more real forgiveness, right? It's not just about fading of memory. It's about saying, I understand that this is not truly who you are. And here's the challenge. There's something in psychology called the fundamental attribution error. And the fundamental attribution error says that when I do something good, I think it's because of me. Mm. I'm just a wonderful person. When I do something bad, I say it's because of the environment. It just happened, right? When you do something good, I say it's the environment. When you do something bad, I say that's really who you are. So, for example, imagine that I slip on a banana peel. I say, oh, it just so happened I didn't pay attention, but it's not really me. If you slip on a banana peel, I say you're just clumsy.
Do you think then this makes us easier for us to forgive ourselves than to forgive other people because of this attribution?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Did you watch this series called Black Mirror?
Yes. It's an amazing series.
Do you remember the first chapter?
Yes.
Okay. So
extremely disturbing. I don't... won't give the details.
So we won't give the details, but the prime minister wakes up in the morning and the princess was kidnapped, and they say he has to... Do you want to describe what... I don't know what's appropriate on radio. He has to have some kind of familial relationship with a farm animal. How about
there
that?
There you go. There you go. We can say with a pig.
With a pig. Okay. And the whole series about is doing it or not doing it, and eventually he does. But as the ending of that is very, very powerful, because what happened is the ending is like a year later, and he's trying to touch his wife, and his wife is unwilling to touch him. Now, for him, he had this relationship with the pig because he had to, right? He can explain to himself. He forgives to himself that he did it. He understands why. But for his wife, he'll always be the person who X'd the pig.
Who did that thing.
To a pig. So yes, forgiving ourselves is really easy because we are really good at attributing whatever bad things we did on external circumstances. For other people, we don't see that. We think it's an essence of themselves. And that's one of the things we need to do in forgiveness. Look, if you did something terrible to me, and I think that's just part of your personality, and you'll keep on doing that, there's just no way to forgive. Forgiveness basically says, I'm willing to make this exception, that one particular thing you did is not a true reflection of who you are.
Right.
And I'm going to separate that instant from your personality, and I'm going to assume that your personality will continue acting in a very in the way I always expected it before this incident. So that's forgiveness. It's taking that terrible experience, putting it aside, labeling it as not a representative of who you are, and then continuing.
So how about in an instance of an extramarital affair, for example, where this instance of someone cheating on the other person does seem to represent more than just the one instance itself? Do you think our behavioral response is drastically different in those situations?
So first of all, with affairs, I think it's very similar to what we talked about before, right? That the people who have an affair have an easier time defining it than the other person.
Right.
I participated in some charity auction, and the people won half an hour with me to talk, like get advice. And this one person called me, and we talked for 20 minutes about her business. She was like, wanted professional advice about pricing. And then the last 10 minutes, she said she wanted to have an affair. And she was wondering, should she have it, should she not? And, you know, I said, look, I don't know what to tell
what
you.
What a question.
Yeah. I said, I don't know what to tell you, but I will tell you that if you decide to do it and then later tell your husband, he will never be able to look at you in the same way, right? So, again, if you have an affair, you could explain it in all kinds of ways and still love your husband and feel that you also get sexual satisfaction outside of the relationship. But your husband will not be able to be in bed with you and not think about that other thing. So A, I think that, yes, we can forgive ourselves much better than other people. And this is the exercise of forgiveness, is treating other people as if they were us,
right,
and explaining things away. And then also I think that, I suspect, I didn't study this, but I suspect that if you explain, like you said, oh, it was a one-night stand, I was drunk, I wasn't feeling control, people would forgive this very differently than a long-term extramarital affair. Again, because you could more easily say, this is not who you are. I can see how this transgression happened.
Yeah. I want to move you in a slightly different direction to talk about apologies. I know you've done some research into the power of an apology. And maybe you can talk about apologies as it relates to corporations and when corporations that have wronged mass groups of people try to make amends.
So apologies are great, first of all, and they really work. And it's amazing how they work. You can think about all kinds of things that people have said, and they said, you know, I'm really sorry. Now, you have to be really sorry. You can't do the same thing again the next day. But apologies really work because they help us understand that that person, too, doesn't think that that instance that we're complaining about is correct.
Mm.
Let's say you and I were married, and let's say I had an affair. And if I say, you know, people have affairs from time to time. Learn to live with this. That's life, right? Now you're not really thinking. You say, okay, that's part of his personality, right? There's no way to put that aside. But if I say, you know, I'm really sorry. I don't know what got into me. I wasn't thinking right. I was confused. I was afraid. You know, I just turned 50. I lost some of my grasp on reality. Whatever I say, I'm basically separated from the standard thing that is the me.
Hmm.
And I'm allowing you to basically trust the basic me again and put that aside.
Does an apology always work? In that situation, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that would be enough.
we don't know anything that always works.
Yeah.
But work, you might still be angry. The question is, will it accelerate forgiveness? And I think
process.
The answer is yes. But we have some really interesting results from corporations. For example, doctors, there's really good research showing that when doctors admit a mistake, there are less lawsuits.
Hmm.
Right? So imagine you're in a hospital bed and a doctor made a mistake, and they do make mistakes, they're human. One time they say, no, I didn't make a mistake. They wrote it was the left leg, you know.
So if a doctor is willing to admit to a patient, this was
right.
a genuine error, I am a human being.
That's right.
We may be more likely to forgive.
That's right. And lawyers usually tell doctors, don't admit it because they can use it against you. Now, it's true that they can use it. Like if, let's say I'm your doctor and I operate on the left leg instead of the right leg, something crazy like this. If I come to you and say, no, you said the left leg, it was your mistake. Right, you're going to be increasingly angry, right? And you're going to sue. If I say, you know what, my mistake. You know, I was in a rush and didn't sleep the night before, and I don't know how I did it, and I'm so, so sorry. It's a terrible thing to do, and I'll try to make up for you. Now, if you sue me, you have evidence that
yeah.
I've done that, but the probability of suing people is much, much lower.
Okay, I want to play you a clip. As you mentioned lawyers, this is a prosecutor who wrote us about a particular struggle that he has had with forgiveness.
My name's Jordan, and I'm calling from Raleigh, and I'm a prosecutor. My view is that prosecutors should always follow the rules. One of the toughest parts about my job is listening to lots of different explanations for conduct. I recognize that people are not perfect, but the longer you do my job, the more explanations you are bound to hear, and the bigger the struggle you're going to have to be certain that a person can truly change, and it becomes harder to forgive. Several years ago, I learned that my mom had been charged with several drug crimes. And throughout the process of dealing with those charges, I also learned that she had a severe substance abuse problem. Initially, I was incredibly angry with her, and I was angry with my entire family back home. All I could think about was I had followed all of these rules, and I was doing the right things, but my mom and the rest of my family had created this huge mess, and I felt as if it was my responsibility to somehow fix it. Eventually, I was able to realize that my love for her would overcome any sort of fear that I had about that situation and how it would ultimately conclude. But I think the question that I really struggle to answer, and perhaps other people have struggled with as well, is how we deal with these really intimate hurt within a family situation and how we can mend the family and continue to grow from that point on.
All right. We are talking about forgiveness today. I'm here with Dan Ariely. Any response or advice for Jordan, the prosecutor?
Yes. So first of all, Jordan is really the tough spot. First of all, as a prosecutor, it is true. He gets a view of the darkest part of humanity, right? And not only that, he defines his own identity in a very, very clear way, right? So let's admit that all of us live somewhat in the gray zone. Is it fair to assume that you texted and drove at some point?
Yeah, I told you last time that you interviewed me on the air that I had done that.
Yeah. So, you know, we all, like Jordan, because of his role as a prosecutor, his boundary as what is acceptable and not acceptable is probably more strict than the rest of us humans, right? So, and for him, sticking to the law is a part of his professional identity, and my guess is also his identity in general, right? So he has created a very strict rule. So what we said earlier is that if you violate something I don't care so much, like you tell a bad joke, you know, that's fine. But you really need to offend me for it to bring to either revenge and for forgiveness to be much, much, much harder. And in his case, because his personality is defined with rules to a very strict degree, it's much harder for him to forgive, right? So we need to recognize that his threshold for that is much more extreme. At the same time, it's his mother. He should stay in a relationship with her. So he has to find a way to forgive. It's a necessary condition, right? Of course, he can ignore her for the rest of his life, but let's put that away. So he needs to come to some terms. And now the question is, what can he do to accelerate it and to make it more palatable? And there are probably things that he can do. There are things that he can do to get her to promise him that this will never happen. There are probably things he could do to understand better the circumstances by which this negative behavior
arose,
and maybe he could understand that and try to help her not to get into that again. So I think all of those would be helpful. But yes, you know, forgiveness is the toughest when we need it the most, right? Because if it's people you don't want to deal with ever again, it's easy to say, I don't care. If it's somebody you really love and you really depend on them, then realizing that they have some very deep flaw in their personality is just an awful challenge.
Dan Ariely is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and the founder of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And just in time for the holiday season, our next edition of Embodied is all about diet culture. And we want to hear from you. Has someone treated you differently because of the size of your body? What is your personal experience with diet culture? Email us at sot@wunc.org to share your stories. I'm Anita Rao.